Iranian president says that Tehran seeks constructive relations with the world, warning any government choosing confrontation with Iran will lose. Iran warns window for restoring the 2015 Iran deal will not remain open forever, calling on the U.S. to stop its deceptive deal. And another Palestinian youth dies after being critically injured by Israeli forces during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Iran's president says that the Islamic Republic is willing to maintain and develop good and constructive relations with the world, including Europe. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with the Belgian Prime Minister, Alexander De Croo. He said Iran is willing to settle differences with other countries through cooperation if they also choose a similar approach. Iran's president warned any government choosing confrontation with Iran based on erroneous and misleading information provided by terrorists and mercenary groups will lose. He also expressed concerns about some European countries' support for terrorists and Islamophobic moves. Raisi said the European countries must not be the origins of plots and threats against the interests of the Iranian nation. Now, diplomatic efforts to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, have been in limbo since September. Iran blames the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal for current stalemate in talks. In an interview with CNN, Iran's foreign minister said that U.S. should stop its deceptive behavior and adopt a constructive approach if it wants to return to the deal. Hossein Amir Abdollahian warned window for restoring the accord is still open, but will not remain that way forever.
With regards to JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been and is the most committed of all the parties involved in JCPOA negotiations. The party that left the JCPOA was Trump and the United States. The United States should not adopt deceptive behavior and instead should return to JCPOA and adopt a constructive approach. Under the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have decided to continue dialogue in order to return to JCPOA. We have had very long discussions in Vienna, and the United States is accusing Iran. It is saying that the Iranians don't have the necessary resolve. They said, "We were at a stage of reaching an accord, but it is the Iranians who are too demanding." I will tell you explicitly that in the past few years, we saw that the U.S. officials were unable to make a decision because of their own internal problems and the pressures they are under. So the window for an accord is still open, but this window will not remain open forever. The U.S. party has been sending us positive messages through diplomatic channels, but in its media remarks, they make very deceptive remarks that are totally different. And really, as an Iranian foreign minister, sometimes I have serious doubts. I receive a message from the U.S. party, emphasizing their commitment to accord. But then in the media, they say that we are not at a point of accord, and that JCPOA is not a priority on our agenda. Which version should we accept? Nevertheless, we are still on the path of reaching an accord. We believe a couple of outstanding issues between us can be resolved, and it can be finalized. But that requires the U.S. side to say the same thing that they are telling us confidentially and through diplomatic channels. And even if they don't want to tell the media everything, at least don't deny it in your media. And then tell us that it is because you are under pressure by the U.S. journalists and have to make such remarks because of your internal situation. Look, if the U.S. side wants to come back to its commitments in the JCPOA, they need the courage of their convictions. We have the courage of our convictions, and we have shown it.
And Iran says it has not exceeded its declared 60% uranium enrichment level. According to the country's Atomic Energy Organization, unfounded claims on uranium enrichment were aimed at undermining Tehran's ties with the IAEA. We discussed this issue earlier with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran rejects claims on enriching uranium beyond 60%. The head of the organization says officials of the UN nuclear watchdog have confirmed that Tehran has not enriched uranium beyond that level. Mohammad Islami says inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency have visited Tehran over the past 2 weeks to check whether Iran has enriched uranium to a purity of around 84%. That's close to the weapons grade level, as exaggerated by some Western media recently. It's been found that there has been no deviation in Iran's nuclear activities. Islami noted that a psychological operation has been launched to portray Iran's relations with IAEA as strained. The Director General of the UN Nuclear Watchdog will travel to Tehran in the coming days at the invitation of the Islamic Republic. Saeed Mohsin Abbas is a journalist and political commentator joining us from London. We also have Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener. Welcome to you both. Saeed Mohsin Abbas, over to you. So it's a case of I told you so. I guess Iran can come out and make that claim. But really, when it has gone to this extreme where you have to have this to be verified, the smear campaign has already happened. But it's been in the works, obviously, for a long time. Why is it that the agency, time and again, is in this political type situation where it should only be giving, statements on the technical level, which in this case, even on that level, it failed?
Well, it's very simple. The IAEA, as we've noted before, is compromised. Its staff are largely engaged through they answer to the money mafia that backs up U.S. with its kind of never-ending wars, and their whole demeanor and their whole purpose is really to put Iran in the dock. The idea really being that the international community should. International community, because of course that just means those nations which support the Western imperialism in that region, that so-called international community should essentially condemn Iran, should be justifying American military action potentially, or assassination actions, or the bombing of Iran, or whatever else it is that the desperation of Israel and America happens to drive them towards over the coming months or years. Of course, the failure of the JCPOA is down to the unilateral withdrawal of the America, their refusal to compromise on fundamental issues, which are essentially going to violate Iranian sovereignty. They don't want them to have any foreign policy towards that region, which counters their imperialism. They don't want Iran to possess a defense capability. They want to limit Iran's economic capabilities. And of course, the nuclear question and this using the IAEA is just one of the many tools that are being employed to really target Iran. You can go through the cultural psyops of the hundreds of anti-Iranian media channels, which the Americans finance. You could talk about the coup d'etats they constantly are plotting and planning, or the color revolutions that continuously fail. The assassination of nuclear scientists in Iran is one of the most blatant violations of human rights and every other law that we know of in this regard. Yet the Israelis have received carte blanche for Mossad to go and do as it likes. So what we're seeing is a kind of a full spectrum attack on Iran, not just militarily encircling it with their own nuclear arsenal from these base camps that they've got surrounding Iran, but also through the cultural psyops, the socio-political psyops generally that we see, through sectarianism, through even ethnicity. So they leave no stone unturned, and the nuclear question, of course, is their worst nightmare, even though Iran is committed to not having nuclear weapons.
Well, on that note, this is where time and again we are hearing false statements, Robert Fantino, when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. Just today, a Pentagon official came out and said Iran is only 12 days away from getting its hand on the bomb, so to speak. I think this was before maybe this news came out, which makes his statement false. Of course, we know that Israel plays a large hand when it comes to falsification of Iran's civilian nuclear program. What can be done? I mean, there's got to be some kind of ramifications behind such an important topic when false statements are being issued, like from the U.S. or Israel.
There certainly should be. We have to remember that Israel, with the support of the United States, has been saying for 20 years now that Iran is a matter of days or weeks or months away from getting a nuclear weapon. 20 years, and still no nuclear weapon. And now they're saying 12 days. The fact that, as you said, this is a vitally important issue. We're talking about nuclear weapons. We're talking about the potential annihilation of the planet. And yet these Western countries continue to maintain these falsehoods, to spread them, to demonize Iran, which is the goal, certainly. The United States only wants Israel to have any power in the Middle East. It wants Israel to be the only nuclear power in the Middle East, although why the United States doesn't condemn Israel's nuclear program, and it's known that Israel has nuclear weapons, and yet does condemn Iran's peaceful nuclear nuclear program, is certainly a mystery. But the international community, as has been mentioned before, should condemn the lies that are coming out of the Western media, the words of the International Atomic Agency, the United Nations branch, should be what is relied on, not rumors, not innuendo, not beliefs that are perpetrated and spoken by U.S. officials. U.S. officials, it's known, the U.S. government has its own agenda. Peace in the world is not on that list. And that has to be kept in mind when anyone is hearing any statements issued by U.S. government officials.
Thank you for that, Robert Fantina, author and journalist. We appreciate it. And thank you. There, our guest in London, Said Mohsen Abbas. Thank you for your comments, political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Another Palestinian youth has succumbed to injuries suffered during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, also known as Ariha. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 22-year-old Mahmoud Jamal Hamdan was critically wounded during an attack on a refugee camp by Israeli forces. Witnesses say Hamdan was being treated by Palestinian medics, but Israeli soldiers halted the treatment and took him into a military jeep. Palestinians were arrested during the raid as well. Israel has practically sealed off Jericho following a shooting on a highway just outside the city that left an Israeli soldier dead. Regime claims Hamdan was involved in that attack. Israeli forces have killed now at least 66 Palestinians since the turn of 2023. Now, the Hamas resistance movement has strongly condemned Israeli Knesset's approval of a bill which authorizes the execution of Palestinians who conduct anti-occupation operations. Hamas said the bill is aimed at legalizing systemic killings of Palestinians by Israeli forces. The movement noted the move reflects the regime's fascist tendencies. Hamas stressed such policies and laws will not deter the Palestinians from continuing their legitimate resistance against Israeli occupation. The bill was approved on Tuesday. Pro-Palestinian groups have warned that the bill crosses a clear red line and indicates Israel's decline into total fascism. Rights groups have also slammed the bill as a clear violation of human rights. The Israeli cabinet advanced the controversial bill Sunday amid high tensions in occupied territories. And a further sign of warming ties with Syria, more Arab diplomats have made trips to Damascus for the first time since 2011. Iran has hailed the developments as a positive step towards solidarity, emphasizing that dialogue and regional approaches can solve the woes besetting the region.
Tehran has described the recent developments in relations between Arab countries and Syria as a positive step. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said the recent progress in relations between Arab countries and Syria, including the visit by parliamentary delegations to Damascus to express solidarity with Syria following the recent devastating earthquake, in addition to being a realistic approach, is a positive step toward Islamic solidarity. He added that regional countries will be able to resolve their problems through dialogue and regional mechanisms if they act realistically, adopt an independent national stance, and pay no heed to the demands of the hegemonic powers. After a deadly quake hit Syria's northern region on February 6th, Syria-Arab relations have further improved, with regional countries sending humanitarian aid to the country amid U.S. sanctions. A delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union visited Damascus on Sunday in a show of support for the country. The high-profile visit was amid attempts by certain countries, above all Iraq, to restore Syria's membership in the Arab League, more than a decade after it was suspended from the 22-member bloc in 2011. In a meeting with the delegation, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad said the visit means a lot to the Syrian people as it indicates support to the Syrians, who are exposed as a result of the terrorist war and the repercussions of the quake. For his part, the head of the Arab Interparliamentary Union, Mohammed al-Halbousi, who is also Iraq's parliament speaker, affirmed that the delegation came to Syria on behalf of all members of the union to assure the Syrian people of their step toward the process of standing with Syria and solidarity with its people. He added, "This visit also came to confirm the importance of working at all levels in order for Damascus to return to exercising its active role in the Arab world." Also, on Monday, in further signs of warming ties with Syria, Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry met with the Syrian president in the first visit by a top Egyptian envoy to Damascus in more than 10 years. Conveying Cairo's message of solidarity with Syria, Shoukry also expressed Cairo's willingness to strengthen bilateral relations. He held discussions with his Syrian counterpart Faisal Miqdad as well. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership in November 2011, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on opposition protests. Syria has denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Back in 2011, Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League and sanctioned by the United States, the European Union, and some Arab countries. But it seems that the recent earthquakes have accelerated the process of normalizing relations between Arab countries and Damascus. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Syria's Sana'a News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. Egypt's foreign minister has arrived in Damascus, Syria, in the first such visit by a top Egyptian diplomat since the foreign-sponsored militancy started in Syria more than a decade ago. Sameh Shoukry met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the presidential palace on Monday, 27th of February, reaffirming his country's solidarity with Syria and its preparedness to continue supporting Syrians in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake on 6th of February. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry also conveyed Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's greetings to the Syrian leader and called for further development of long-established and friendly relations between the two countries. Sameh Shoukry described relations between Cairo and Damascus as essential for protection of the Arab world against potential threats and challenges, stressing that Egypt will always support any initiative that could help Syria and would serve the interests of all Syrians. President Bashar al-Assad, for his part, underlined the historical significance of Syrian-Egyptian relations, emphasizing that promotion of diplomatic ties among Arab countries will actually improve living standards in the Arab world. He also appreciated Egypt's warm welcome of Syrian refugees following the outbreak of the crisis in his country, stating that such a behavior attests to the strong ties that already exist between the two nations. The Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry told reporters upon arrival in Damascus, he said, "The goal of this visit is primarily humanitarian and to pass on our solidarity from the leadership, the government and the people of Egypt to the people of Syria." The development comes only a day after several Arab parliamentary speakers and high-level legislators arrived in Damascus to restore Syria's membership to the Arab League, which was suspended nearly 12 years ago due to the foreign-sponsored conflict in Syria. The lawmakers were received by Syria's Speaker of Parliament, Hamouda Sabbagh, who stated that Syria's return to the Arab diplomatic fold is crucial for any joint Arab action to confront the current challenges and crises. The English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has received a delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union, which is in Damascus to discuss restoration of Syria's membership to the Arab League after more than a decade of suspension from the 22-member bloc. The meeting took place after the heads of the Iraqi, Jordanian, Palestinian, Libyan, Egyptian and Emirati parliaments, as well as representatives from Oman and Lebanon, arrived at Damascus International Airport on Sunday, 26th of February. President Bashar al-Assad said, "The delegation's visit to Syria today means a lot of the Syrian people, as it indicates the support to the Syrians, who are exposed as a result of the terrorist war and the repercussions of the earthquake. Appreciating the Arab country's rapid response to help the Syrian people after the devastating earthquake," President Assad said, "the visit also affirms that there are effective Arab institutions capable of taking the initiative in various circumstances and moving in the interests of the Arab peoples." Stressing that the strength of popular institutions comes from the fact that they represent the different spectrums and the different spectrums of society, Bashar al-Assad said, "This diversity is an opportunity for dialogue and searching for common points of strength to be the basis for joint Arab action." For their part, members of the parliamentary delegations expressed their readiness to provide all possible support to the Syrian people to overcome the earthquake, saying, "Syria has never stopped serving the causes of the Arab peoples, considering that the Syrian people are able to overcome the effects of the earthquake just as they were able to confront the war and the blockade imposed on their country." Mohammed al-Halboussi, the president of the Arab Interparliamentary Union, said the delegation came to Syria on behalf of all members of the union to voice support and solidarity with the people of Syria. Mohammed al-Halboussi praised Syria for having opened its doors to all Arabs at various stages and underscored the importance of working at all levels for the return of Damascus to exercise its active role within its Arab surroundings. The president of the Arab Interparliamentary Union said, "We cannot do without Syria, and Syria cannot do without its Arab surroundings, which we hope it can return to." The Arab League suspended Syria's membership in November of 2011, citing an alleged crackdown by Damascus on opposition protests. Syria has denounced the move as illegal and a violation of the organization's charter. Syria was one of the six founding members of the Arab League back in 1945. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad has visited Oman and met with Oman's Sultan Haytham bin Tariq al-Said. Following the devastating earthquake which rocked the northwestern sector of the country 2 weeks ago, claiming the lives of thousands of people, President Bashar al-Assad and his accompanying delegation landed at Muscat International Airport recently and were received by the Omani monarch. President Assad and Sultan Haytham bin Tariq al-Said later held a face-to-face meeting at Beit al-Baraka Royal Palace in Sieb near Muscat, where the Omani king offered his condolences to the Syrian government and the Syrian people with regards to the earthquake. He also stressed his country's unflinching support for Syria in order to help the country cope with the aftermath of the earthquake and the repercussions of the foreign-sponsored militancy, as well as the unilateral sanctions imposed by the West on Damascus. For his part, President Bashar al-Assad expressed his gratitude to the Omani monarch, the Omani authorities and people for their solidarity with Syria and delivery of humanitarian aid. He also appreciated Oman's support for Syria in the fight against Takfiri terrorism. The talks between the two Arab leaders also focused on age-old relations between Muscat and Damascus, with a special emphasis on expansion of bilateral ties in various fields of common interest. They also exchanged points of view on the latest regional and international developments and efforts underway to guarantee security and stability in the West Asia region. President Bashar al-Assad said Oman has always adopted balanced policies and stances vis-à-vis regional issues, calling for Muscat's stronger role in promotion of relations among Arab countries based on the principle of mutual respect and non-interference in the affairs of others. Oman was one of few Arab countries to maintain diplomatic ties with Damascus after a breakout of foreign-backed militancy in Syria in March of 2011, in spite of pressures from the United States and other Persian Gulf countries. Meanwhile, the Arab and International Campaign to Break Siege on Syria announced plans on 24th of February to launch a popular pan-Arab campaign to confront the Western-led blockade against Syria through an aid convoy in light of the devastating earthquake that has killed over 50,000 people in both Turkey and Syria.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear ladies, this is your program. We are in here. That is Muslim Lady. Welcome to a new episode. I am Asma, and in here I have Sister Zainab, as always. We're going to have her to help us with the description that she's going to give us. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome to today's episode.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And thank you for being here. Previously on Muslim Lady, we've been talking about visiting the relatives and how important it is to do this task, because we have been so much recommended on doing it in our Islamic heritage, and all of our imams and all the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam have been doing that and recommending us to do that because it is going to have so much of blessings for us, and not only in this world, but also in the world to come. And it's going to count as an important rule in our religion. So we talked about the people who hate socializing, and we actually gave them quite some advices to follow in order to have this socializing with the family. And then we actually have been through too much. But right now, we are going to talk about what are our responsibilities toward the relatives when they are gone, when they no longer live in this world. So, Sister Zainab, what are our responsibilities toward these relatives when they are gone?
See, when they are gone, basically, you realize really how important it was to visit them.
Yeah. That's the point with every single thing. After you lose them, everything becomes so important.
I wish I did this before. One of the hadiths from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that just visit your relatives. Just do silah rahim with your relatives. Just visit them, even if it's just salam.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're just, you know, sometimes some relatives live very near together. And if it's just saying salam, it's okay. I remember we have the relatives living very near to us and he's suffering from cancer even. All of a sudden, mm-hmm. I don't know from where, it just, you know, kind of came to my mind. And I had a kind of intuition, he's not feeling well. And I started making soup without informing anyone. And then told my husband to take this soup for them. And then at the very moment, we realized that he had not been able to eat anything for a couple of days. And all the soups they had been making were not working with him. But the soup that I had made worked for him.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you can be really a source of what I said, be a savior or be something. Sometimes, for example, I don't know, visit the relative directly. I sent my husband with something that I could have.
There are different ways and different means.
I could
means.
Have afforded.
Yeah.
So Imam Ali Ali Sam is saying just salam. So, you know, you said after death. After death, we really realize, I wish I could have done this for the particular person. I wish I could have done that for the particular person. Or I wish I had at least visited.
And regret comes in the middle.
You know, all those regrets of visiting relatives come into your mind. But however, when it comes back to Lady Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha, she had a very great connection with her relatives. Mm-hmm. She never forgot them, even when they were gone. And she teaches us how we can maintain our relationships with those who are gone. The one who is gone is not just gone. He has just transferred from one world to another world. We have a very beautiful word in Urdu for someone who passes away. We don't say someone is dead or someone just passed away or something like that. We just say intikal. We use the word intikal in Urdu, which also has a good meaning in Persian. And the intikal is also a word in Persian, which means transfer.
Yeah.
So we actually want to say that the person is not gone all the way. He is just...
They've just been transferred into another world.
Exactly. So we even use the word transfer for death. We don't use any other word.
It's more precise, actually.
Exactly. So she had a much great faith in it, and she maintained that relation through visiting cemeteries, praying on their graves,
mm-hmm.
reciting a Quran for them. And today we have so many beautiful apps. I just lost my loved one very recently, and I created one of the links on one of the apps wherein you can do the Khatme Quran, wherein you can do the, for your loved ones, for those who are gone. In the name of many of those who are gone, you know, you can recite Quran. So I shared the link with many of my relatives who could have actually picking up half of the Jews and just recited it. And that's one of the services you could do to those who are gone. And especially the families.
So let's just skip this family point for after the break. And I would love us, everyone, to go for a sip of water and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
We're Welcome back, dear ladies. We are talking about the social aspects of the lifestyle of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha. We talked about how to treat our relatives, and that was what Sister Zainab was going. I guess you wanted to mention something else about this family stuff.
Actually, when relatives are there, she took extreme care. And when relatives were gone, she would actually take care of many things. She would actually, first of all, take part in the funeral.
Yeah.
Recite the prayers, which is highly recommended in Islam.
Yeah.
Show emotional attachment towards
and, them. You know, it would be very much important for the family of that dead person. They would care for every single person who shares sympathy with them.
I remember one of the funerals I attended of one of my colleagues. He had lost his mother and brother at the same time.
Oh my God.
And that was a big shock. And his brother was younger.
Yeah.
So we as a staff went there and attended the funeral. And his sister was crying so much. She was just putting the mud of the grave over her
shoulder. She had every right to,
I understand. You know, I just went into the crowd, put my hand on her shoulders. And when she saw how is this, I told her, you don't know me, but I want to hug you. Yeah. When I hugged her, so you can just give a hug, you can give sympathy, yeah, you can console that person one or the other way.
Just be a shoulder.
Exactly.
And this is the main point of attending those funerals, in order to be the shoulder for the people who have lost their dear one. We understand that a person who has lost a dear one is going to go through too much, specifically since we're talking about Muslim ladies, and ladies have a delicate heart.
See, I couldn't, as a Muslim lady, I couldn't go and console my staff member, my colleague, you know. I went to console his sister, at least.
Of course, yes.
At least her sister, you know.
And showing sympathy with the sister, which has actually worked so well, because she has told, she relieved me with that hug.
Prophet, peace be upon him, recommended that those who have lost a dear one, at least for 3 days, get them food.
Yeah.
So she would do that. She was the first person who would do that. She lost her brother-in-law. He was a martyr. And she shed so many tears. And she actually they had all that emotional attachment, because, you know, when you have a brother-in-law, you treat that brother-in-law as your own brother.
Exactly.
And when you have sister, you treat them as your own brothers and sisters. That's what happens with every married woman.
So there is a family bond.
Yeah, there's a very good, very strong family bond, even gets developed after this marriage. And since she was a direct student of prophetic family.
So again, providing them with food means sharing that sympathy, knowing about their needs, and being there for them.
You know, when you lose someone very dear to you, someone very close to you, who is in the senses of cooking and feeding your children,
exactly,
and
yeah,
yourself and all?
They would forget about themselves.
It's recommended at least for 3 days this person is in grief. You as a neighbor, go and give them. You as a relative, go and provide for them. So if you as a relative are far away, it's the duty of neighbors.
Exactly.
And since then, it's been carried out. Even in our country, India, we have this. Like in the Kashmir, we have this system of, like, if someone passes away, they don't turn on the gas stoves for at least 3 days themselves. But the relatives or neighbors say that.
Now, speaking of culture, I would say that in our culture, we have it that for 40 days, we don't leave those family, you know. Every week, at least, you have to go and visit them. If you can do, if you're in the same city, you can go there and do it every night. You know, sit with them, talk to them, make them feel
sympathy. Or at least recite Quran rather than talking.
Exactly,
because when women get together and start talking, that sometimes ends up into something.
No, you know what? When somebody is lost, and then the person who has lost the dear one, and they start talking to you.
No.
It feels as if they are just giving the burden from their shoulder out to another person. It feels like they are feeling empty.
Yeah, what I have seen, realized, observed, is that when women, I'm not talking about the one who has lost someone. For example, the one who has lost someone, is there... And the neighbors out there, they meet each other and they start talking. Rather than coming and consoling this person who has a great grief right now. Rather than coming to this grieved person, giving him condolences, And then talking to...
And they start talking about
yeah.
stuff that are unnecessary. So before we go further, let's go for a short break. And then it would be the final part of today's episode. Dear ladies, this is the final part of Muslim Lady for today's episode. Sister, is there anything still left for us to talk about?
Well, the same thing, like, you know, when we are taking part in the funerals, we're just condoling the other families. We have to take care of, at the very same time, we have to take care of this thing that get engaged with the grieved family itself. Not yeah. with the neighbors, not with the relatives. At least show your sympathy, show mm-hmm. your humanity. If not sympathy, at least your humanity.
Exactly.
Because that's something that shows up here. I was saying that she would shed tears, and she would say so much tears, Prophet, peace be upon him, would get tears into his eyes. So, and then he would wipe her tears with his own clothes.
Yeah.
So, you know... It's all
very kind.
The emotional bonds, the attachment mm-hmm. shows us everything.
So and she still, all of these things that we have been recommended to do with our relatives is just to keep the connection and the bond stronger and deeper. When somebody is lost from the relatives and you go to their family, you feel that the connection is going to get deeper and deeper. And the family that has lost a dear one, they wouldn't feel they are alone. And exactly. I guess this is the main idea.
Exactly. And not just those who are living. Those, the one who has just left or the one who, the relatives, those were gone, she would often visit the cemeteries. She would often visit their graves. She would often recite Quran over there. She would mm-hmm. often ask Allah forgiveness of their relatives. If she would find out that the graves are in need of repairment, she'd go for it.
Yeah.
She'd do it. So this is very important. Like if someone is left, if someone leaves this world, it should not be 1, 2, 3, 4 and over. Or
exactly.
like 1 to 40 and over. You just forget about them. No. Or you just remind them on Thursday, send a Surah Fatiha and that's it. Just visit their graves. Just see if there's some kind of repairment is needed.
Mm-hmm. We have also so much of recommendations on going to the cemeteries and visit the dead ones.
Exactly. You remember, that's what's called as ibrat for us,
yeah.
which has been called as lessons for us. If someone leaves this world, it's a lesson for
yeah.
us.
We also have this quote that there are lessons in the cemeteries. So when you go there, you just feel like you have too much of new things that you have learned. Even though you do not know anyone in there. But then the view, the sight of that cemetery is going to give you so much of feelings and insight, I guess.
You know, Surah Al-Kasr says you see so many graves, the number of graves, and you just still don't remember. So
yeah.
Everyone who has come has to be going. And visiting cemeteries reminds us of our death and it actually revives our soul.
Exactly. So, sister, I would love to talk more, but the time is running so fast. And this was all that we had for today's episode. Until another session and episode, I will bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Anti-war protesters have recently gathered outside major American airbase in EU. Demonstrators descended on the Ramstein military installation in Germany, calling for an end to Western arms deliveries to Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Global Times wrote in this regard, after protests in several European countries against the continuous supply of weapons to Ukraine, experts say the divisions within the European Union may also lead to a split within NATO, and the public outcry reflects the strategic misalignment of European countries, making their citizens the biggest victims. According to The Guardian, thousands of people took part in a demonstration recently in central Berlin to protest against giving more weapons to Ukraine, urging the German government to de-escalate the crisis by paving the way for negotiations instead. Police estimated there were 13,000 people at the Brandenburg Gate. Similar demonstrations took place in other German cities as well, The Guardian reported. The protests in Germany were relatively predictable, since Germany is one of the countries most negatively affected by the Ukraine crisis. Zhao Jian, director of the Center for European Think Tank Studies at Shanghai International Studies University, told the Global Times recently, "Europe's interests have not only been harmed by Ukraine crisis, aggravated energy crisis, but also by the implementation of Washington's Inflation Reduction Act, which has pushed Europe into a deeper economic crisis." According to The Guardian, 2 weeks ago, the organizers of the recent demonstration had published a manifest for peace in which they urged German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to stop the escalation of weapons deliveries. It was signed by about 650,000 people, including prominent intellectuals and political figures. The Russia-Ukraine crisis allowed the U.S. to achieve its strategic goal of sowing discord between Russia and Germany. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said in a recent television interview that he does not see any prospect for peace talks at present. Norbert, a former troop who held a banner reading, "The real enemy sits in the city of London and New York," a reference, he said, to the financial powers, who he claimed were behind the war and had no interest in it ending. Germany, he said, had no right to participate in another war after the Second World War. The Guardian quoted him as saying. According to China's national broadcaster CCTV, hundreds of people demonstrated in Zurich, Switzerland, against the shipment of weapons to Ukraine recently, calling for an end to the implementation of sanctions against Russia. Demonstrators also called on Switzerland to stop moving closer to NATO. The U.S. manipulating its allies and desire to contain Russia have also turned off the European people. Sun Kegin, a research fellow at the China Institutes of Contemporary International Relations, told the Global Times, adding, "So, amid the so-called great unity, the rifts within Europe are actually getting deeper." The EU approved a tense package of sanctions against Russia recently. The package includes tighter export restrictions regarding dual-use goods, as well as measures against entities supporting Russia. Relations between Europe and Russia will be harder to repair after the 10th round of economic sanctions, Zhao said. Once investment flows out of Russia, it is hard for Europe to bring it back. The counterproductive reaction to such sanctions can be very damaging to European countries, he warned. For European people, defeating Russia is not a realistic goal, but stopping the conflict is the most effective solution. If the European and Russian economies were to decouple as sanctions become more and more expensive, it would deal a devastating blow to the European economy. Kahan International also noted, people across Europe have marched to protest against the war in Ukraine. Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Brussels and Paris, Berlin and London, to protest against supplying Ukraine with weapons. Thousands of people took part in a demonstration in central Berlin to protest against giving more weapons to Ukraine, urging the German government to de-escalate the crisis by paving the way for negotiations with Vladimir Putin instead. Police estimated there were 13,000 people at the Uprising for Peace at Brandenburg Gate, organized by Sarah Wagenknecht, a renegade member of the Linked Party, and veteran feminist campaigner Alice Schwarzer. The organizers claimed as many as 50,000 took part. Similar demonstrations took place in other German cities. In a speech at the protest, she spoke of the start of a citizens' initiative and a starting signal for a new strong peace movement in Germany. She said the demonstrators had been united by the fact that they did not feel represented by the government of Olaf Scholz and his foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, over their decision to provide Ukraine with weapons. Protesters carried banners reading, "Helmets today, tanks tomorrow. The day after tomorrow, your sons," in reference to the manner in which the coalition government has increased its military support for Kiev, initially donating 5,000 helmets and more recently agreeing to send German-made Leopard 2 tanks. Other banners in the demonstrations read, "Diplomats instead of grenades, stop the killing, and not my war, not my government. We are like the slaves to war and the warmongers," said Norbert, a former soldier declining to give his surname, who held a banner reading, "The real enemy sits in the city of London and New York," a reference, he said, to the financial powers who he claimed were behind the war and had no interest in it ending. Germany, he said, had no right to participate in another war after the Second World War. In London, protesters chanted anti-war slogans as they held banners against sending more weapons to Ukraine. The group later marched toward Trafalgar Square. Jeremy Corbyn, a former Labour Party leader and member of Parliament for Islington North, was among the attendees at the anti-war protest. Dalia Sanchez, an anti-war activist, said she just wanted to see the end of the war, as so many people have lost their lives regardless of which side they are on. I don't agree with sending weapons to Ukraine because it extends the war, she said, adding both NATO and Russia should engage in talks to prevent more escalation. John Clark, another participant at the demonstration, also said he thinks NATO's eastern expansion is not right. I'm here today just because I think we need to stop the warmongers and we need to reconsider what is happening, he added. I want to see ceasefire and talk for peace, said Clark, adding, we should be sending diplomats to Ukraine, not weapons. Also in Italy, thousands of Italians also demonstrated across the country in Rome, Florence and Genoa against Western sanctions imposed on Russia and transfer of lethal military hardware to Ukraine. The protesters chanted no to war and peace, demanding an end to the war and urging the Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's government stop supplying Kiev with weapons. Anti-war protesters also held demonstrations in Milan, Italy's second largest city, Pisa, Florence, and Lecce, among several other cities. We represent the majority of public opinion that does not want war but wants peace. We are not only pacifists, we are radically against any war. And the goal we want to achieve is to overcome war as an instrument for regulating conflicts between states, said Maurizio Landini, a socialist in Rome. In Genoa, people took to the streets and chanted, Exit Italy from NATO, calling for Italy's withdrawal from the European Union and NATO. Other slogans, such as, Down the guns, raise the wages, were also shouted. We know well that the problem is another, and it is this system that produces this war. We are workers, students, we are different souls. As the polls also show, there is 60% of Italians who are against sending of arms and against this military adventure, said one protester.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.